Welcome to Fate's Wide Wheel, a Quantum Leap podcast with Sam and Dennis. We are coming to you from our top secret headquarters at Project Quantum Leap, but you can find us online at fwwquantumleappod.com or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And please do us a favor by hitting the subscribe button on iTunes. All right, here we are, Project Quantum Leap. We will be discussing Double Identity today. It was written by Donald Belisario, directed by Aaron Libstadt. The air date was April 21st, 1989. Our leap date is November the 8th, 1965. And Sam has leapt into Frankie the Hitman. Dennis, why don't you give us a little TV Guide synopsis?
So here is the TV Guide synopsis. When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. But when Sam, Scott Bakula, is a hitman fooling around with the Mafia Don's girl, that's a mess.
That's an understatement.
Somebody wrote that copy.
They did indeed.
Somebody wrote that. And they died a little inside.
Well, you know, it's interesting as a historical fact that TV Guide was so present in so many households.
Oh, God. Oh, yes.
And you used to read it. Like, you literally used to read it because sometimes you didn't know what you'd be watching. And somebody was paid to write stuff like that in order to generate some sort of interest or maybe not. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But at least give you some information about the show.
Oh, absolutely. It was a highlight of my week when we bought next week's TV Guide. Like, that was a...
right?
That was an event.
Going to the grocery store and seeing the new issue there, it was like, oh, I gotta get that.
Yeah, I remember my mom was all up in about the Family Matters issue.
What was the Family Matters issue?
Yeah, it was just the Family Matters.
Oh, yeah, got it.
And I was like, chill out, Mom.
Yeah. I only need so much information about Urkel.
I was in a show a few years ago, Frankie and Johnny and the Clarendon Lane, if you're familiar with that
one. Oh, yeah.
And the director, he went and he ordered a bunch of TV guides off eBay, just because she was supposed to have a bunch of like different like magazines and stuff sitting around. And at one point, I was playing Johnny, and Frankie like throws a bunch of the TV guides at me. And like at the first rehearsal that he brought, there was like, I found the one from my birthday week, birthday week. Like they were that old, and I'm like, I'll be taking that one.
Thank you very much.
That's very cool. Somewhere at home.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and you used to like you would save covers. Like I remember because my dad was a big Elvis fan, so he still has like you know Elvis covers, and I had some Star Trek covers. In fact, I remember when Deep Space Nine went off the air for its series finale, there was like a series of four different covers or something like that, and I had all four covers. Yeah, I don't know if we still have them or not.
Yeah, I remember this a few years ago, it was probably like 2001, 2002, like TV Guide did their top 25 cult TV shows of all time.
Yeah.
And I think Quantum Leap landed on number 12, and I'm like, yeah, that's legit.
Right
there.
Exactly.
Right there. So speaking of segues, back to Quantum Leap.
Yeah,
two minutes in, already off on a tangent.
Well, it was an interesting one.
Yes. Listeners, you can already tell that we have a guest.
We do indeed. Christopher Sir, would you like to introduce yourself, perhaps, to our listeners?
Christopher Stewart. I'm big in all things pop culture. I'm not big into Quantum Leap in that I've only seen a couple of episodes, but from what I've seen, fantastic shit.
Yes, excellent. Yeah, we were talking earlier. You said that you'd only seen maybe like four episodes before tonight. We're recording on a Saturday evening, and Chris and I have actually been sitting here and we watched a couple of episodes in the lead up to our recording session. Dennis arrived, and now we're off. But it's always interesting to come back to an episode after having not seen it for a while. Okay. And I think that with an episode like Double Identity, watching it for the first time, I mean, I probably hadn't seen it in over a decade at least.
Wow.
And now I've seen it twice in the past like week and a half. And it's very interesting to rewatch it because there's so much that I feel like the episode does right. In particular for setting up the template of the series in general. And I think one of the interesting things to mention right off the bat is that this was originally supposed to be the first episode aired after the pilot.
Yes.
It was the first episode produced and taped after the pilot, and they decided to move it to later in the production block. It's interesting because Belisario's reason, which I'm not going to reveal yet,
absolutely,
because I want to wait until we get into that particular part of the episode. I kind of scratched my head over. I'm sort of like, oh, is that okay? Yeah. I mean, that's fine, but
I mean, yeah, I'll save my comment to there. Yeah. Actually, when we were getting ready to record the first block of episodes, I don't think I ever actually ran it past you. But even though we said we were going to do the episodes in air date order, this is the fifth episode if you count the pilot as one episode.
Well,
I was going to suggest to you to make this the second episode
that
we recorded and released, because it was supposed to be the second episode. And in my mind, like it like in my head canon, it is the second episode.
It makes sense with some of the stuff that happens within the episode, I think, especially when considering it coming right after Genesis and some of the stuff that happens in that episode. That I think it would make sense story-wise with the flow of the story.
Well, not just story, and I think we may have talked about this in the pilot. I feel like in the pilot, they were trying to establish this idea that whatever situation Sam leaped out of, he would leap into a somewhat physical or similar physical situation in the next episode. Like in the pilot episode, like he's reaching out a window to catch a baseball that his son is throwing up to him, and then he leaps into a baseball player catching a pop fly in the outfield. At the end of the pilot, he's laid spread out on his back, and the start of Double Identity, he starts spread out on his back. So I think an idea that they quickly abandoned was this idea that he would be physically in a similar position to wherever he was.
Interesting.
The last time.
For six episodes before just like...
After that,
What's the type of thing I feel like once the audience noticed it and the jig was up with the gag that people just wouldn't... They would kind of be like, you're saying, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Very much like, did you ever do improv?
Yeah.
Sam? Like the improv game Freeze?
Yes, absolutely.
Where you come in and, you freeze an improv scene and then you pick up the exact similar position. Yeah. Yes.
That was actually, believe it or not, that was probably some of the very first, acting exercises that I ever did back when I was in 7th or 8th grade. Were improv and Freeze specifically. Because it was a great way, I think, for our teacher to keep everyone involved. You get two people up there, you go, somebody else freeze, somebody hops in, So, but that makes sense as far as the new situation that Sam would find himself in.
So, Sam, so he, improv leaps in Freeze.
Yeah.
Into Frankie, spread out on the floor.
Wow. And he looks up. And actually, before he even looks up, we hear the voice of a woman talking about how great that was.
Who's smoking hot, by the way.
Yeah. She is.
Wow. Teresa. You were terrific. If I'm lying, I'm dying.
If I'm lying,
I wish my wife,
dying.
Betsy, was guest hosting. She does this perfect New Jersey wife accent. Betsy is not an actor. She is not in the performance world. She would be too embarrassed out in public to do any of the accents or the dialects that she does at home. But sometimes she will just like let them go. She has a great New Jersey, no disrespect, fuck your mother.
That's awesome. Yeah, well, you just have to record her at some point and we'll drop it into
get in there. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
When she's completely unaware.
Yeah. So so he leaps into Frankie and Teresa standing over him.
And Teresa is played by Terry Garber, which one quick factoid about her is that she played Ashton Maine in the North and South movies with Patrick Swayze.
Wow.
And it's so interesting because I did not know that until IMDb'd it. And completely different character. I mean, like, the fact that she is playing this sort of toxic Southern belle, kind of sultry character in North and South, and then the character that she plays in Double Identity, I feel like there's a lot of differences between the two, and it's interesting to just kind of see her range in that. Of course, she did a lot of other stuff, but that was something that I picked up on IMDb that I thought was interesting. Yeah, beautiful, fits the part perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just seems like the Mafia Don's, daughter or not in this case.
No, definitely not.
But fits the bill.
Mm-hmm. At first, I thought she was the Mafia Don's daughter.
Right.
But I learned quickly after some creepiness that
there is not. So we have this brief scene of Sam pulling himself together, look in the mirror. Becoming more adept or attuned at like looking in the mirror and getting used to seeing a different
yeah.
face look back at him. And he's very taken with
Frankie. He is. He thinks that Frankie is quite dashing. And feels like that this is what a tux is supposed to look like on a person. And he even says, "Eat your heart out, Al," which I think is hilarious because, you know, the first time he ever sees Al, Al is in tux in the pilot episode. And man, so it's an interesting little callback. And then immediately after this, we proceed out into the backyard wedding scene. And it feels so much like the... you know, lighter version of the first scene from The Godfather, which is the first, two? No, the first one.
The first one?
Yeah, well, because, well, actually, so they actually both have weddings in them, but in the Godfather one, the first scene is the wedding in the backyard, you know, Corleone house, and, you know, the daughter's getting married, and yeah, so it's an interesting parallel, and it makes a lot of sense, again, what we've talked about earlier with kind of fitting into certain genres and playing off of those. And this is clearly their Godfather episode.
Yes. And I also think it's interesting, we talked about this with how the test was won. They almost, like, once you get Sam established what his situation is, they immediately break away from him for a few minutes and they set up this entire... They set up the world that he is in.
Which is cool because we see it through Teresa's eyes because Teresa's, like, going around and, like, talking to people. And it's great because, I mean, let's face it, she's absolutely in this post-coital bliss mode where she's, like, just drifting through each little scene, talking to all of the people. And, like, she's having so much fun and feels so good about herself. But you can tell that some of the people are sort of giving her the side eye, like, why is Teresa so happy?
We do.
You know, what's she doing?
We know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's also because maybe she felt bulletproof. You're the mafia don's toy.
Yeah.
You could say whatever to anybody. So I guess she was going around that wedding just being bulletproof, I guess.
No, that's a good point. And I think that it because it's something that we don't find out right away, it's interesting to see her interactions with all of those people. Then to even see her interaction with the bocce game where she comes up. And she's got the, you know, the bend over scene where she flashes her underwear to the old mafia guys and everybody's like, you know
those old mafia guys were like, God bless America.
Yeah, but of course, like you're saying about she's feeling bulletproof, they're not, because they all turn away, hide their eyes, because the Don's sitting right there. And in addition to what you're saying about bulletproof, the next thing that she does is she awards the game into Frankie's dad's favor, away from Gino. And Gino gets kind of mad and, like, takes her into the garage and, you know, kind of balls
her out. The creepiness ensues.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and he's clearly very, very possessive. Michael Genovese is the actor that plays Gino, which is the perfect name for a guy who's playing a mafia don. And did a bunch of other television. It's interesting, in this episode in particular, a lot of the actors did just a ton of other famous TV shows, you know, whether it was Magnum P.I. or Hardcastle and McCormick or Twilight Zone or MASH or, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like a string of, like, popular television shows.
You know what else I noticed? Everybody looked fantastically dressed.
Well,
to a T.
And not only what they were wearing, but their hair.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And the reason I bring that up is this episode actually won an Emmy Award for Best Hairstyling.
Was this the first Emmy that they won?
It was not, and I feel like this is something that we should have mentioned, and maybe we did, I don't think we did, but actually the pilot won an Emmy for Outstanding Cinematography.
I can see that.
Yeah, which is something that we didn't even talk about in that podcast, so go back and listen.
And re-record.
But, yeah, so it did. It won an Emmy for hairstyling. And you're right, everybody looks great. And I think that goes hand in hand with a lot of stuff we've talked about with production values in general in the show. They tend to keep them fairly high. People are dressed well, dressed period appropriate.
Period appropriate.
The cars look good. The music is right. You know, I mean, it feels very authentic.
Even the hitman's gun was time appropriate.
Right?
That's the first thing I noticed. I was like, is that a after war 45?
Yeah.
Oh,
and which...
Nice, you know, catch.
Before we get to that, though, let's go back real quick, because after the moment in the garage with Gino and Teresa, Sam has come out and is now making his rounds and has a couple of very fun moments, especially with the with Nona.
Yes,
at the food table, and she starts just going off in Italian, and he has.
And they'll be like, "Oh boy, I'm supposed to speak Italian." Yeah. I think this may be the first "oh boy" moment in the episode, maybe.
Yeah, I think it might be the only one in the episode. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but yeah, he realizes he's supposed to speak Italian, but it sets up. You don't know what she's talking about, but the word "bingo." Mona throws out the word "bingo." That sets something up for later on in the episode.
Yeah. Oh, and so the interesting thing about Mama that I really wanted to bring up when I found this out, because in doing some of the research, she's played by an actress by the name of Harriet Medding, and the reason I bring that up is because she was in her first role ever, actually, was in a film called Paisan by Roberto Rossellini, and it's it's a brilliant piece of post-war film from Italy. And it was, filmed in, bombed out streets. And, it's very much the neo-realist movement began with movies like Paisan. And I remembered her immediately when I read that because she plays Harriet the nurse. It was one of the things that he did oftentimes is he cast people that he just felt like looked like what he wanted, or they had the right profession. Mm-hmm. He didn't work with a lot of actors early on. Most of his films would have maybe two or three actors, and the rest of the cast would just be regular people that he found, and he decided he wanted to film them. It's a brilliant, brilliant film, and I encourage you to check it out. It's a part of his war trilogy, and it's an incredible, incredible piece of work. And when I found out that she had been in that and realized, oh gosh, that's the same person. I don't know. It was thrilling for me anyway, mm-hmm. just because I was like, oh wow, how about that? And I wondered if in 1989, if, anyone, producers, directors, casting directors or whatever were aware and thought to themselves, wow, we've got this person. Mm-hmm. Probably not. Cause in a pre DVD, Blu-ray streaming sort of era, it was not an easy film to come by unless you were probably in a film school or going to an art house, film or whatever. But anyway, she has the funny moment with her speaking Italian at him. He recognizes bingo.
Mm-hmm. And then we get to Primo, who is Frankie's brother. It's Primo and Angela's wedding.
Yeah.
Primo wants him to sing for their wedding.
Yeah.
And Angela has chosen Volare. Yeah, and he gets thrown up on stage to sing Volare.
Yeah. It's funny because this is really, if you think about it production-wise, this is the first time that Scott Bakula ever got to sing within the context of an episode. It's not the first time that we've seen him do that, though, because we saw him in
Right Hand of God, kind of singing Amazing Grace.
That's right, right. Yeah. But this is really the first time we hear him sing. And, his musical theater background doesn't really come into play at first.
Yeah, but then it kicks in. It's funny, yeah. Well, Al shows up, and so Al starts feeding him the words. And it is comical how Sam warms up very quickly to the song, and he starts eating up the attention. He even does this thing, after he gets through into the second verse, and he does this cheesy...
Points to
someone.
Yeah, and he does like a count off at one point. He's like, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, and this is when we've talked about this on previous episodes. The way Sam was originally envisioned, he was supposed to be a more comedic character, and Scott Bakula actually fought to have him become a more dramatic character and kind of be like the straight man to Al. And I feel like this is like an example of an early episode where you kind of see where I think Don Bellisario originally envisioned Sam as far as the comedic delivery.
Yeah. Although I will say that one thing that's interesting about this episode as the whole is that it's a very balanced Sam as compared to what we get from some of the other episodes, because I feel like there are certainly some, comedic moments that are hammed up a little bit. But that there are also some really passionate, heartfelt, more serious moments that foreshadow, I think, the direction that the character and the show would take. In fact, I would even argue, in spite of this being produced before the other episodes, that this feels more like Sam to me than Right Hand of God or How the Test Was Won.
Mm,
this feels more like the character that we would get to know over the course of the series than those two episodes.
Later on. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So he finishes up Valari.
Well, actually, while he's singing Valari, we get another interesting bit. It cuts away to the Don and the Don's right-hand man. And I'm looking at the information here. I'm not ever sure if we ever get the right-hand man character's name.
I don't think so.
But he is played by Mark Margolis.
Can I give him a name?
Yeah.
The Don's right-hand killer.
there we go.
Like, he had that smirk where the Don would, like, look at him and say, I want this guy off the planet in 30 seconds. And he's just like, yeah, all right.
Go get it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that.
Absolutely.
Don's right-hand killer. So that DRHK.
There you go.
Yeah. So DRHK, played by Mark Margolis. I don't know if you recognize him. Do you watch Breaking Bad?
Yeah.
He is Hector. Salamancas. No. Yes.
Seriously?
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah. Got him. For the listeners at home, I got him pulled up on the internet here.
Wow.
Yeah. Have you watched Better Call Saul yet?
I've seen most of the first season.
Okay. Yeah. I don't think he shows up after, I think starting more with the second and third season, Hector Salamanca shows up more, but it's pre-wheelchair. Wow. Actually, third season, you see the events that make him the way he is.
Wow.
When it comes to Breaking Bad.
It's great what I've seen of it. I just haven't had time to, you know, to really dive in. And
it's a slower show. The first season especially, the first season of Breaking Bad is slow. The first season of Better Call Saul is slow. It benefits from being able to binge watch it.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So just dive in and just go. I think Betsy and I, a couple of months ago, we went through all three seasons in 2 weeks.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So anyway, so the Don's right-hand killer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lets the Don know that Teresa managed to give him the slip for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And they already suspect that she slipped off to have fun with someone else.
With someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Get a meat injection.
And at this point, yeah.
Get what?
Get a meat injection?
Yeah.
And one of the things that happens in this particular moment too is that Gino says the thing about making whoever it was sing Soprano, and at that point Sam hits
Soprano
falsetto note.
And I also love it's just a pure coincidence. Like after this, the most iconic piece of mafia entertainment that's going to come along in the next decade is The Sopranos.
Yeah.
On HBO.
Yeah. Well, which is great because, and since we've already seen him, I feel like I can say this, Frankie's dad, Frankie Primo and Segundo's dad, Joe Santos, was in The Sopranos. Not only was he in The Sopranos, he also had a co-starring role in The Rockford Files.
Yes, yes, that's where I recognize him from.
The Sopranos.
Yeah.
And yet another one of those actors that had, and I wrote some of this down because I was just so amazed, he was in Police Story, A-Team, Twilight Zone, Hardcastle and McCormick, Remington Steele, MacGyver, Magnum P.I., Murder, She Wrote. So clearly he was a guy that was just around, during the 80s, doing every TV show. Mm-hmm. And like you said, Rockford Files, he had a co-starring role with James Garner.
Yep.
So much so that he was in all of the Rockford Files movies that they made in the late 90s.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, and then he was in Sopranos. He passed away a little over a year ago, actually March of 2016. He was also in, as a piece of Sam trivia, since we're getting some of my film stuff in here, one of my favorite films, The Friends of Eddie Coyle, which is a great movie with Robert Mitchum. It's just this wonderful crime film, underappreciated, doesn't get seen a lot. There's a Criterion Collection DVD/Blu-ray of it that I own. Mm-hmm. The novel is also very good, but check it out. And since we're on that track, Primo is played by Nick Cassavetes, who is John Cassavetes and Gina Roland's son. John Cassavetes, who arguably started the independent film movement with some of his movies in the late 50s and early 60s, and was famous for The Dirty Dozen, among other things. And Jenna Rollins, who's arguably one of the finest screen actors ever. She's incredible and was in The Notebook. amongst other things. So yeah, it's an interesting cast, quite the pedigree within the cast. But I digress. Clearly,
while we're on the film track, I've always found it interesting that the name of this episode is Double Identity, and on its surface, it's almost like it's playing on the film title Double Indemnity. But in tone, nothing like it at all. Because Double Indemnity is a 1946 film noir movie. More similar to anything played against Seymour, which is the last episode of the first season.
Yeah.
But...
yeah, that is interesting. Well, and I think that the double identity has many meanings, which we'll get to later as well. But no, that is interesting. I didn't think about that at all, which is another great film, is Double Identity. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, Sam finishes his rendition of Valar. Well, we actually don't see him finish it, but we cut to... a scene back in the attic.
So commercial break and then back into the attic with Al. And this is where we find out basically what is at least one of the primary plots of the episode is that they are planning to retrieve Sam.
Right.
In the next day or so.
Which is, you know, again, looking at it in the context of it, you know, ending up airing when it aired is interesting because that's not something we've really heard about since the pilot episode. Mm-hmm. But then when you put it in the context of this being the second episode that was produced so soon after the pilot, it kind of makes sense that they're still trying to get him back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they have a theory about how that can be done. Well, I mean, Ziggy's working on it. And as such, has turned off all non-essential functions at Project Quantum Leap, including the air conditioning.
I think this is the only time in the entire series that we see Al... in shorts.
That's probably right.
I didn't notice that. I was too busy watching him sweat profusely.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe it's because, like, watching it now, like, I grew up with this, like, you know, like, standard definition TV, and now in, you know, Blu-ray, high definition, Dean Stockwell's pale legs just
pop out.
Just pop.
Like a shiny.
They're like right in the room with you.
I would be willing to guess it's probably one of the only times that Dean Stockwell ever wore shorts, much less the character of Al.
And you know, there was some talk where they were like, okay, it's hot. We're going to have to get you to wear shorts. And he was like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I haven't worn shorts since 1974. You get some spray tan?
Last time I wore shorts, I was in a desert with Peter Fonda doing peyote. I'm not ready for this. I made that up. I don't know. I mean, I imagine Stockwell probably did do that, but might not have been in 74 with Peter Fonda.
It is very possible. But that is the danger of high definition now. I remember reading years ago when high definition started to become a thing, some actors were really getting freaked out by it.
Can't blame them.
Because, not just actors, but even news anchors.
Yeah.
Because like, they were going to be more honestly seen. I don't know if that's the best way to put it, but...
That's the nice way to put it.
Yeah. Right.
They were going to be shown for the grotesque monsters they really are.
we're looking at you, Tom Skilling.
Yeah, right.
And like...
Tom Skilling.
I recently just got a high def TV, and there are some times where I'm staring like, what is that on your forehead, dude?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a hair? It looks like a copper wire.
it's true though, and even in the latest Star Trek series, you know, watching some of the close-ups of the characters' faces, there are a couple of times when Jess and I were watching it last weekend, and she looked at me and she was like, is that makeup or is that person really like broken out right now? Or like, and it's true, you notice those things just so much more. It's like, oh, you know, somebody had a pimple that weekend.
Not much you can do.
Right.
But anyway, so Al's in shorts.
Al's in shorts. Project Quantum Leap has all non-essential functions off. We also, Sam does sort of a trip through memory lane for himself when he finds out what year it is. Mm. And in addition to mentioning LBJ, he also brings up Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And Al's response to that is very telling. He says, "Don't remind me." And he says it in a very, like, it's not, you know, it's not a light sort of like, don't remind me, you know, it's a very laser guided, don't remind me, you know, I don't want to know, I don't want to think about this. And, you know, Vietnam has already in two previous episodes, in Star-Crossed and in Right Hand of God, has gotten a little bit of play, if you will. And as we will talk about more and more, it's no coincidence. You know, Vietnam is a very, very important element of Quantum Leap.
I think it's interesting because it's very much like Vietnam was that era. It's like any time, like you see any TV show, like talk about the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, it's in the very similar headspace for me. But to speak to what you're saying, like Dean Stockwell gives the weight of that line, actually. To not give spoilers away, if you just happen to be watching the show along with us or haven't delved much past the first season, you learn more stuff about Al in the second season that Dean Stockwell had no clue about.
Right.
Until they dropped on him in the premiere of the second episode. He was like, oh, I have to totally rethink this character now.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, like, he does manage to give that line some weight so that even looking back in hindsight that...
And, you know, one of the things that I do enjoy about this episode, especially compared to How the Test Was Won and Right Hand of God, is that Al is very much a part of the plot, and his character also it feels like Al. In much the same way I was saying earlier, this feels more like Sam as we get to know him. This feels more like the Al that we get to know throughout the series as well. And I don't think that was what we got from How the Test Was Won or Right Hand of God. You know, I think that this feels more right than those two episodes did.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But anyway, so... Sam is going down memory lane. Yeah. So he remembers Vietnam... but Al points out that, Sandy Koufax, is that it?
Yeah.
He pitches a perfect game.
Yeah.
Sam recalls that he is 10 years old.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Which is accurate, as we'll learn later on. He's probably 11 or 12.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and then, we also get a great moment with Al, noticing the disarray of the room.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, he's just recently blown the fan on himself. Mm. And Dean Stockwell does this great little thing where he's kind of like rearranging his hair and he's looking down at the scene before him. And he's just sort of like, oh, I know what happened here. It's like, and based on Frankie's condition when he got into the waiting room.
I love that visual. It's like, well, Frankie's condition when he arrived in the waiting room left little to the imagination.
Yeah.
I just love that.
Oh.
That weird, interesting visual what that must have been like.
It probably wasn't pretty
but it's of note because what Al says is that even though all of the details of how they're going to retrieve him aren't concrete yet, Sam is going to have to be doing whatever he was doing at the moment that he leaped in at the time of retrieval.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's some stakes.
And we also find out at this point, Al informs him that he's a hitman. And Sam is not okay with that. Mm. And this is one of the reasons, too, why I said what I said about feeling like we really get to know who Sam is and will be, is that his reaction to that feels like Sam.
Yes.
It feels very... He's not okay. He's not even okay with inhabiting, you know, the same space as a person who killed people, much less even imagining that he might have to do that. You know, Al immediately tries to allay his fears. You don't have to kill anybody. And Sam's just still like, I don't care. Mm-hmm. This is not okay. And it is a really nice moment. It's played very well because, it seems like one of those moments like what you were talking about that Belisario could have been like, oh, it's comedy. This will be a fun little gag where he's like, ah, I don't want to be a hitman. Mm. And instead, you know, Scott Bakula plays
more genuine,
dead serious, and it really plays nicely.
And plus, it's more impactful that he does play it serious because nobody wants to be trapped in the body of a killer, especially if you do that for a living. So
right?
It made it that much more believable.
Yeah, I agree. So after the scene in the attic, we then get this wonderful, obvious Hollywood backlot, but nonetheless, wonderful New York street scene with the three brothers, which is another thing that, could be nothing, but it's interesting to note that in The Godfather, there are three brothers, we've got our three brothers, they're joking, they're talking around. Primo is being a little crude about his wedding night.
Yes.
Having given Angela all the honeymoon she needs.
Needs, yes.
Sam is, grilling him about, like, why did you even marry her? To which Primo then kind of pulls him aside and is like, you told me to.
Yeah. Kind of puts his foot in his mouth, yeah. It was your idea to move in on the Carluccis.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The Carluccis. Mm-hmm. Not the first time that we'll hear of the Carluccis.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But then Sam sees Teresa in a window.
Yeah.
And decides to get his haircut. See, to me, you talk about, like, this episode, like, it's more of who Sam is. Throughout the series.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like this is a very un-Sam moment where he sees Trace in the window and he decides to go get a haircut. And it's like, it's with no motive for, like, what he's there to do.
Sure.
Which, by the way, 5 episodes in, this is the first episode where this far into the episode, like, there is no objective. Like, there is no Sam is here to do something.
Right.
Because the only focus that the project is on is
the retrieval.
Is retrieving him. Yeah. So there's not really anything that Sam is working towards.
That's a really good point. Yeah, he's not
right now.
Yeah, there's no life he has to save, nothing that he needs to do to put anything right. It's it's literally the objective is we're working on a way to get you back, try to stay out of trouble in the meantime, basically. Yeah. And then, of course, what does he do?
Yeah, he goes in to get a haircut from Teresa for no other reason than...
Right.
This was the woman that was standing over him when he leaped in.
And there's a great bit about how men probably weren't getting their hair cut by women in the 60s and all this sort of stuff. And when he walks in the door, there's that, could hear a pin drop moment where everybody's like, what?
Yeah. So, yeah, he goes in to get the haircut. Like you said, like all the women kind of clear out. And I think Trace actually clears a customer out.
Well, because she's giving her the beehive do.
That's it, yes.
And Sam has that funny little line of dialogue about how her hair looks. And, he's trying to be complimentary, but he's not really being complimentary. And the woman doesn't know how to take what he's saying. And there is that moment also where she's probably sitting there seeing Frankie. And they all know who Frankie is.
Mm-hmm.
She's just like, the hell is he doing talking about my hair? Mm-hmm. Come on. And so, yeah, Teresa shoos her out and... ends up, she doesn't just plop him down, cut his hair. She's giving him a shampoo.
Yeah.
She's going, like, the whole nine yards.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, his dad, Frankie's dad, shows up and is, asking the brothers, like, what's going on? Mm-hmm. Is he out of his mind? And and then, of course, Gino shows up.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And at this point, Chris, what did you say?
Oh, what did I say?
You were talking about, that was it. He's going to get whacked.
Oh, yeah. It was totally going to get whacked. Like, right in the chair. Like, oh.
Yeah.
In comes the Don. The Don sees him with his toy.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't mess with that. You don't touch the Don's toy unless you don't want your hand anymore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't rub another man's rhubarb, as Jack Nicholson said.
In 1989. Fine. Yeah, exactly. In 1989.
Batman. Well, what does Don Gino say? My condolences on your youngest paisan.
Yeah.
Or something along that line.
Yeah, he does. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And then goes inside.
He goes inside, Frank's father has to say, like, no, like, this is why, like...
Yeah. Like, I told him to.
I told him to because maybe,
women are talking to each other in the hairdresser.
They'll just say anything and maybe it'll let slip like who he's actually or who she's actually sleeping with.
And then the Don's like, well, all right, I'll go check this out, but no talking with your hands.
Mm-hmm. what I love is like he goes in and the brothers immediately start talking with their hands right in front of the Don's right hand killer.
Mm-hmm. Ah, yeah. Forgot the right hand killer was there.
That's right.
And he's just standing there like with the smirk on his face, like he knows what's gonna happen.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the end for him. He wants to give him a shave, and Sam's like, I shaved this morning, and I always shave in the and Don's like, he says this thing about, 5 o'clock shadow. Nobody likes 5 o'clock shadow. And Sam's all like, well, some women do. And the Don's like, who? And he's like, well, not in 1965, they didn't.
Yeah. Well, no, it's some line like, 5 o'clock shadow isn't so big. And the Don says, what about, and he actually like says a date, like, what about whatever, whatever.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, no, I guess...
And he does all this while he sent Therese off to get a razor, and she comes back with
the safety razor.
With the safety razor.
And at that point, I'm thinking to myself, thank God she just saved his life.
Mm-hmm.
There's not anything you can do with a Bic, right?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Little to my imagination, it's still 1965, and with that razor, she, the Don then screws it. Hello, razor.
Yeah.
Goodbye, vein in your neck.
And now he's just got that blade.
Yeah.
Yeah, getting ready to shave Sam. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And at this point, the Don starts speaking in Italian to Sam. Because he doesn't want anybody else to hear the conversation.
Yeah, because, like, I'm going to ask you why you're here.
Yeah.
And if you answer right, you're just going to get a good shave.
Right. Yeah. And so, of course, you know, Sam and viewers are in fear for his life at this point.
Yeah. And then he starts talking in Italian.
Yeah. And luckily Al shows up.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy. Yeah, perfect moment. Mm-hmm. But before he shows up, Sam says Volare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Al's like, no, you just
told him to fly away.
Yeah, you just told him to fly away. And then, of course, Al starts helping him, and it's a really great moment because, Sam's enjoying himself speaking the Italian, and Al is clearly very into this conversation, and he starts really just rapid fire with the stuff. And at one point, you know, Sam's just staring at him, and it's great because the Don looks over. Like, what the hell is this guy looking at? And, you know, because Sam can't keep up with what Al's telling him to say. And, but luckily, it's enough. And it gets him out of this situation, which is interesting because the whole bit plays off, you know, in a comedic fashion without a doubt. Yeah. But there's also this wonderful strain of tension through it as well. I mean, clearly we know Sam's not going to get his, you know, throat slit by the Don.
Why
but,
not?
But it's still...
I mean, let's be honest. It's 1965. It's an Italian hairdresser. Everybody in there knows who the Don is. He could have slit that guy's throat. And nobody would have said anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's, no, you're right.
Just go to bingo that night. And
that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Bingo. We'll get there. you know, that's very, very true. But it's funny because not only do we get this wonderful play, you know, the juxtaposition of the tension of that scene and the possibility of the harm coming to Sam and the comedy and the bits with the language and trying to keep up with that and, you know, and Sam looking at Al. But there's also a lot of mirror imagery that's used, and it's great because we see, you know, we see Frankie a lot with the Don, and we see, you know, we see Sam's expression on Frankie's face, if you will, a couple of times, which is very funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a nice use of the mirror imagery, which I feel like we don't, you know, in How the Test Was Won, we barely get any mirror imagery at all.
Absolutely.
In Right Hand of God, there are a couple of really interesting moments at the beginning, but other than that, not a whole lot after that. And so this one, it's cool because there's a lot of play with the mirror image. You know, Sam kind of playing with the mirror image at the beginning, this happening now, and there's even some more stuff later. And so it's just the whole scene is a really great set piece, I feel like, for Quantum Leap Season 1.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I got.
But yeah, so we get out of this situation and they get back on the street and wrapping up with his brothers and the dad, we find out that we get another thing. Take Mona to bingo tonight. She thinks that you're good luck.
Yeah.
And I think this is when we cut away when we see Sam and Al talking to each other, and this is where I misspoke earlier. This is where Sam gets more instructions from Al saying that he has to be doing exactly whatever he was doing, but at the same time, he has to plug in a hairdryer at this address over in Brooklyn just a few minutes prior.
Yeah. And of course, he's like, how am I going to do that? Yeah. I can't get there. And, you know, and, but obviously he figures out a plan, you know, just like, I guess this is what I'm going to have to do. There's some really great moments here, with Al, he does the, hop along Cassadich.
Yes. Line, that moment, yeah.
Which is great. He talks about the orphanage. He talks about his dad. He talks like there's all of these little moments, you know, kind of peppered in this little, and again, it's like we're learning, a lot about Al that I feel like we didn't get in the last two episodes at all. And this feels like, you know, if this were the X-Files, for instance, this episode would be like a mythology episode, you know, in a weird sort of way. Yes. But it would. This is like carrying over that bigger arc of a story. Whereas Right Hand of God, How the Test Was Won, they're kind of throwaways, honestly. Fun episodes, but they're not as integral to the overall development of these two characters, in my opinion.
That's interesting. I don't know if I agree. Like, yeah. you learn some tidbits about Al. Like, in the first scene, he talked about how when he was 10, he took so-and-so into the coat closet at school because he was socially advanced. Right. And then this one, he talks about his dad comes to spring him from the orphanage one weekend and brings him a girl.
Yeah. At son, a young, it's time.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I don't know if we're learning anything really deep about Al in these...
Sure, but it feels like it's...
Yeah, I mean, you're learning more than Right Hand of God or How the Test Was Won, certainly.
Yeah, yeah. It's a tenuous comparison at best, but...
For sure.
You know, yeah.
And the X-Files, I could never get into. I always tried to get into the X-Files.
Yeah.
I think I always caught X-Files when they were airing the fluff episode right after they wrapped up the major storyline.
Sure.
And since there was so much hype around it, like, I would watch the episode, and I'm like, this is it?
Yeah.
This is what people are talking about?
Hey, you know, some people argue, I'm not necessarily one of them, but some people do argue that some of those standalone episodes are far better than the arc
the
episodes.
Overall mythology.
Yeah. I don't know. I watched a good portion of it. I've not seen every episode, but I, you know, the first few seasons I have, and afterwards I kind of drifted away from it a bit, but I've seen most of it through to the final episode. Didn't watch the new series yet, but anyway.
So we find out that, Sam has to be with Teresa in the attic.
Yep.
Also have to plug in a hairdryer. He comes up with an alter plan, getting his brothers to go.
I
would have loved to have seen that conversation.
I know, right? Well, because there's even the conversation between the two brothers in the car where they're like, you know, what are we doing? Like, this doesn't make any sense at all. And, you know, Primo's just sort of like, you know, Frankie said, and so we're doing it.
I love this idea, though, like in the mafia... like in a mafia family, like there's this weird corrupt sense of honor of like, I'm going to tell you to do something.
Mm-hmm.
I just want you to trust me and do it.
Yeah.
You're not going to like it.
Mm-hmm.
It might not be enjoyable.
Right.
But just do it because you owe me.
You know what? One other thing real quick, in the whole Al moment, he says bingo, bango, bongo for the first time.
Yes.
Which is something that we'll hear again.
Come back in a year and a half, dear listeners.
Yeah, right.
and we will explore that episode.
But yeah, so he's convinced his brothers to do this thing, and they show up at the frat house. We're going to do this a little bit out of order because we're talking about the brothers anyway.
Yes,
so
yeah.
They show up at this frat house, and it's great because Primo, like, he's got the hairdryer, and he, like, walks up, and this, you know, frat guy walks out, and he's like, what are you doing? And, you know, he's like, I need to plug this in. And the frat guy tries to give him a hard time, and Primo draws a gun on him.
Yeah.
Just, like, points a gun right at this guy's chest.
It shuts him right up.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can plug it in right over here.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the comments that was made by Chris's girlfriend, Nicole, and my wife, Jessica, as we were watching the episode this last time around, I was like, that guy's way too old to be a college student.
Yes, I think that's a running theme in a lot of entertainment of the era.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even try to make them pass.
How old are you? 32? Ah, that's fine.
Sure, come on in.
Yeah.
30 years from now, when people are watching this in high definition, won't be a problem.
No. Crow's feet? Sure.
Yeah, come on. Yeah.
Is that gray in your hair?
So he plugs in the hairdryer.
Yep.
And immediately we should also mention, like, it's in front of a frat house, like we're in frat row, basically, and the lights immediately, like, go out, transformers spark,
That was some good Transformer work, too.
That was a nice little...
Uh-huh. It was nice and round, and...
Yeah, they spent some money on that one Transformer.
Well, and as I, you know, as probably quite a few people listening to this would know, that blackout was a real event. November 9th, 1965, the Northeast had a blackout, a sustained blackout, like 12 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, over 30 million people, 80,000 square miles. It was intense.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is yet another one of our kisses with history.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting because, like, for this kiss with history, they had to create, like, this entire set, briefly introduce these two actors, like, working at the power plant, like, freaking out.
Right.
And my wife, Betsy, she was watching this episode with me at this point. And she was like, oh, wow. They're acting. They are acting so hard.
Yeah.
It's like, we're losing the grid.
It definitely is.
Mm-hmm.
But before that happens, mm-hmm. There is a great phone call between Sam and Teresa, mm-hmm. where Sam has, you know, now he's convinced his brothers to go to this thing.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Now he has to get Teresa to come with him. And he is, you know, he's laying it on. He's like, I got to have you again. We got to do this again. It's got to be in Don Gino's attic. And she flips out. Mm-hmm. Like, what are you crazy? Mm-hmm. You know?
I think a thing that we glossed over at the beginning is that they were in Don Gino's attic. And that makes it even worse. That heightens the stakes even
Not
more.
Not only in his attic during his daughter's wedding. Which... I don't know if you know, that's the tools for getting whacked on site.
No ifs, ands, or buts about that one. And so then there's this funny, amusing line of dialogue that, you know, I was better there than I was, you know, under the L tracks. I was better there than I was at the furnace at the church. I was better, you know, all this sort of stuff. And there's this really interesting cut that happens because they're talking on the phone, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden there's this cut and they're together in the attic and Sam's responding to
the thing on the phone. And I think it's behind the furnace at St. Anthony's.
And it's a really funny moment that, you know, in your head, you kind of imagine that they got off the phone shortly after this. They meet up in the attic, and they're hugging and everything. And all of a sudden, Sam's like, "Wait a minute!
Like, yeah, wait, excuse me. What now? Say what now? Yes,
I went along with everything to get you here, but I just have to say,
wasn't she also doing that in the salon with like her coworkers there?
Right. She was having a phone sex call
with her boyfriend.
It was starting to go that way.
Yeah, she kicks off her shoes.
Yeah, she kicks off her
shoes. Put her legs
comfortable.
She's leaning back in the chair.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is a funny moment. And they both play it very well. And then when we get to the attic, you know, there's some really, really fun stuff that happens there. Sam says, "Awesome." And Teresa's like, "Awesome? Mm-hmm. What is awesome?" She's like, "I like awesome." Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, great. Sam has just invented awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
actually, I think, like, looking that up, I can't remember, like, what source I read it at, but, like, awesome was already fairly in use at the time. It's one of those terms that we think is a much more modern term than what it is.
Sure.
But to the average person... The average viewer, they would go, "Oh, awesome is really out of place in 1965."
It's been around for hundreds of years. I mean, they're like
hundreds of years.
I mean, it has been.
But like as a slang expression of
right, exactly as a slang expression, mm-hmm. absolutely. But it, I mean, no, it was getting used. You know, it was getting used by President Kennedy. It was getting used by Mark Twain. It was getting, you know, mm-hmm. what I mean? Like it's been used for quite a long time. But it is fun that she's like never heard of this expression at all, especially mm-hmm. in this context.
Yeah.
And now she likes it. She's probably going to use it.
But she's ready to be awesome.
She's going to, and she's going to go back to the hairdressers and she's going to be like, "Your haircut is awesome."
Mm-hmm.
Like, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah.
But then there's this really wonderful, tender, sweet moment, and it's Sam.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm talking about. This is when we really get to know Sam, because again, his reaction to being a hitman and what he says to Teresa here, that's who Sam is.
Mm-hmm. Because he can't go, like, even though he knows like this is what he needs to do to get retrieved, he can't go through with having sex with someone that he doesn't have feelings for.
Yeah. and, you know, just talking about everything that she deserves and, you know, and how she's special. And, you know, and the thing is that it's not, he's not laying it on. He's not trying to get her to sleep with him. He's not, you know what I mean? Like, he's just genuinely like, you're special. You're, mm-hmm. you're great.
And he's a better man than I am. Well,
hey, Terry Garber looks good in the episode, you know. I mean, what can you say?
He had like this big, wonderful smile and these big brown eyes, and she was gullible and sweet and tough.
Yeah,
she had me from the get go.
A few years ago, there was a crack.com article that makes the argument that Sam is technically raping every woman that he has sex with on a leap. Because he's having sex with them under false pretenses. They think they're having sex with someone else, and he's him.
Sure. Who wrote that shit?
Really? Yeah, I mean...
Anyway, yeah. I feel like that fits more... Because I feel like there's only one instance where I would consider that. Because, like, most leaps... For one, he doesn't have sex with a lot of women through the series. He makes out with a lot of women.
Right. Yeah.
A lot of them, like him getting intimate with a woman, is a step towards his overall goal for why he's there. I can only think of one instance where he sleeps with someone and she thinks that she is sleeping with a very specific person that she has been intimate with before in the past. And he is sleeping with her because he knew her in his actual life as a kid, and he's fulfilling a childhood fantasy.
That's some sick shit.
Okay, all right.
All right, then we're crossing.
Okay.
Oh, boy. Wow. Okay. Yeah,
all right. It's a stretch, but that I understand. But what is that, like 3% of the entire... Mm-hmm. times he hooked up.
Yeah. And then, well, you know, and one could argue too that, I mean, in addition to that, I mean, he's also potentially cheating on his wife if he actually has a wife at the time that he's doing the leap, because mm-hmm. maybe he doesn't and maybe he does. We don't really know because mm-hmm. things do happen.
Things are left up in the air.
Right. Yeah. But they are left up in the air as to whether or not she actually exists. Right. Yeah. It is an interesting thing to look at within the confines of the show. Of course, it all makes sense. Mm-hmm. But I think there's definitely some validity to it. That said, I firmly will fall into the camp that believes that most of those women, if not all of them, would have absolutely slept with Sam Beckett if Sam Beckett was in front of them.
True.
And think about it. Like, if he's sleeping with a chick from 1955... You know he's throwing her some moves where she's like, where the fuck did this come from? You know he's dropping some shit on her where she's like, oh my God.
That reminds me of the scene.
Married to you for 30 years. Where was this?
In High Fidelity, when I think it's actually not, I don't know if it's in the film. It might actually be a cut scene, but when Harold Ramis, who plays John Cusack's dad, looks at him and he's like, the good lay wasn't even invented when I was your age, you know? So that's a good point. That's a good point. All right. Well, let's go ahead and go back so that we're not here all night.
For sure. Yeah.
So there's this really tender moment there, and I always liked it. And again, that passionate Sam that we see there, and that genuine, heartfelt Sam is something that I've always liked to see. And it's really cool to get that at that particular moment. Of course, things start to proceed as planned. The power is starting to not yet, but the brothers are getting ready to do what they need to do. And, of course, at this moment, Teresa and Sam are interrupted.
The Don.
The Don shows up.
Well, I love, like, we skipped over a previous scene where the Don's right-hand killer, like, he's by the Don's, right. Car window, and he was like, I saw them sneak up, I saw it myself, in my attic.
Uh-huh.
In my attic. People don't have respect. Oh, I'm going to teach him respect. And like he pulls
he's
up.
Putting the
he's putting the silencer on. Yeah.
Yeah. And now he shows up. He bursts in. And it looks like Sam's about ready to...
There's no weaseling your way out of this.
No.
Yeah. It's like, no. Something like, how is it that two of my own can show such disrespect?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then eventually there's a tussle.
mm-hmm.
between Sam and the Don.
Mm-hmm.
And as
well, even before that, like there's like this little argument where like Therese argues, like, no, I can be with who I want to be. Like she, right. yeah, she confrontational. Like she's defiant against him.
Yeah, mm-hmm. she's not. Yeah, she's not gonna back down.
Which she
down.
Was earlier, but yeah, I'm like she's taking a stand. Like she's not gonna back down. Like if you have to kill us, kill us.
Right. Well, and something else that you know that happens earlier in the episode, towards the very beginning, is that. When they're having the scene in the garage and he's, you know, kind of coming on to her and basically treating her like, you know, she's his property and, you know, you're my side piece, whatever. And she's very defiant in that moment too. And she even looks at him at one point and says like, I broke this off. And, you know, he's very much like, you know, oh, you don't break this off. I mm-hmm. break this off.
But he's also kind of turned on by that.
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
Yeah. Because she speaks to him like he's just a regular guy.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, anyway.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But it's, yeah, it is great to see her stand up. You know, she mm-hmm. doesn't shrink away from the fact that here's this guy with this gun. Like, she would rather take the bullet and be out of this than have to, you know, owe anything to this douchebag.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, there's the tussle with the Don and Sam. And during that tussle, we get, honestly, you know, all spoilers aside, one of the more unique moments of the entire series.
Mm-hmm.
With the blackout happening and the retrieval starting to happen, and in that moment the retrieval can't complete, and so what happens? Sam switches places mm-hmm. from being Frankie to now being the Don.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really interesting moment, mm-hmm. and there's a great. There's a, you know, there's a great sort of comedic bit where Sam looks in the mirror and sees himself as the Don.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, great.
No, the Don. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's this really great moment where, you know, he's trying to figure out what can he do mm-hmm. to make things right for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an interesting piece of dialogue that he has where he's convinced, like, if I set you two up and I say that I'm okay with it, it doesn't really matter because as soon as Gino gets back here, he's going to have you two killed anyway. And it's interesting because it makes you think, oh, the people that are in the waiting room have no idea what's happening
mm-hmm.
here.
Well, at the same time, Frankie is leaped back in.
Yeah.
And he thinks it's still the day before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, which is interesting because it does kind of go against some of the other things that we've sort of theorized,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that fans have been theorizing for years and years and years mm-hmm. and years. That what is happening when they're sitting in that waiting room. And even stuff that we'll come to find out, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It is an interesting little bit. Where you don't know exactly what's been going on. And I guess one could argue that Frankie probably thinks that because they saw him when he arrived and they've been struggling to figure out how they're going to retrieve Sam this whole time and haven't paid mm-hmm. any attention to the guy in the waiting room. So mm-hmm. you could certainly...
So they haven't been catching him up on anything.
You could explain it away if you wanted to.
So mm-hmm. you think Frankie thought he got whacked while he was in the waiting room?
That's an interesting thought.
He thinks he's in heaven?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because, like, he's having sex with the Don's daughter... And he's just in the waiting room. Right?
The Don's girlfriend.
Oh.
We should clarify.
We should clarify.
That guy was a whole different show.
Yeah. That's fourth season. No.
Oh, no. Oh, wow. No, but that's a really interesting point. Because it does make you wonder. It could, mm-hmm. There are, again, you know, as the show goes on, and we'll talk about this more and more, we do learn a little bit about what's happening in the waiting room mm-hmm. and what certain people are thinking when they get there. But at this particular point, it's all whatever we're making up in our heads. And so that's a really fascinating perspective. It's like he gets there and he's like, am I dead?
Probably thinking that when he got back too, because he was like, if I wasn't dead, I am going to be mad.
Now, because immediately he sees the Don and he's immediately
right
jumping in and trying to make up an excuse and like, this isn't what it appears. And
So
this is where we get Sam starting to basically talk to himself, like, how do I figure out, like, he even says in a voiceover, it's like, now that I was the Don, I know why I'm here.
Yeah.
To get them together.
And as he's trying to put the pieces together, he even looks at them at one point and he's like, you know, do you two love each other?
Mm-hmm.
And it's great because Frankie is all like, I don't know what you're talking about, you know, and Teresa's like, I love him, you know, of course I love him, and, you know, and to hell with you, and I love him, and all this sort of stuff, and then at one point, you know, Sam just kind of looks at Frankie, and he's like, tell me the truth,
mm-hmm.
and it's this really kind of nice moment, because even Frankie, like, kind of just straight as an arrow is just like, with all my heart,
mm-hmm.
And it's, yeah. you know, and it's like, okay, yeah, these two deserve
yeah.
to be together.
But I love, like, before that, there's a moment where Sam is talking to himself, like, I don't, blah, 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 and then the real Don leaps back, and then you end up like Jimmy Hoffa.
Oh.
Jimmy Hoffa. I'm in the Teamsters?
Yeah.
yeah.
and even Teresa's like, wow. yeah. But then he comes up with a plan with Bingo.
Mm-hmm.
And so they all go to the Bingo Hall. And it goes up to the father, and you know the father's like, I can't just. It's got to be an official pronouncement. There's got to be all these things, and you know, of course, as the Don, he's just sort of like, do me a favor, you know, come on, do me a solid here.
Mm-hmm.
And so he announces it in front of everybody, you know, that these two are going to get married, and that it's with the Don's blessing.
Everybody's so happy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I almost feel like it, like in this moment, like everybody in that Bingo Hall knew that Frankie and Teresa were making time together.
I bet
yeah, right.
Like it was like a bad secret that everyone knew, but the Don.
Yeah, yeah. But if you say anything about it, mm-hmm. you know,
right?
With the fishes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't want to upset anybody in this equation.
Mm-hmm. So they're probably just all relieved, like, oh, thank God this happened.
Right. Now we can go back to our bingo. Mm-hmm. Which in that particular moment, Sam kind of walks off to the side, and Al reappears.
Mm-hmm.
And Al reappears in furs and like a
like
fur
a fur fuzzy hat.
Hat.
Yeah. There is a great moment before that, this comedic moment where Sam thinks he's done what he's supposed to do, and so he just takes this pose like, I'm going to leap now.
Yeah.
And the priest like turns around and he catches him. Like there's this awkward like look back and forth of. Like, oh, you just saw me do that. Let's let's pretend that didn't happen. But then Al shows up in the furs.
Yeah.
And crawling, walking out of the furnace.
Right. Yep, out of the furnace.
At St. Anthony's.
And at this time, you know, basically says, yeah, the retrieval failed. Ziggy's going to start up the systems, but it's cold right now because it's the desert at night.
Well, basically says, like, he failed because Sam didn't follow the instructions to the decimal
point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Lord. Yeah, which we know what that means. Mm-hmm. And Sam's like, great, now I'm going to have to, you know, live out the next 40 years as the Don. And Al's like,
no,
that can't happen. He gets whacked by the Carlucci's in May or something like that. And Sam's like,
yeah.
And I was like, but don't worry, I know what you're here to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then he points him over to the the bingo, and he pulls the number, and you know,
Mona wins.
She wins.
Bingo. And, mm-hmm.
Yep.
And this is another thing to bring it around to the beginning of the episode. This episode, he leaps out, like, kind of doing, like, this, like, spin and turn to show Al the magic ball.
Yeah.
Which corresponds to him turning around from the blackboard at the start of Starcross.
Interesting. That's really good.
Yeah. But to jump back, so we talked about the beginning of the episode, we said, originally, this was supposed to have been the second episode aired. The reason why Don Bellisario chose not to have it be the second episode aired is that he thought the double leap in an episode would be too confusing for audiences, and he didn't want to scare them off two episodes in. Chris, what are your feelings?
Kind of a mistake. I mean, I think audience might have been smart enough to get it back then, but there's no for sure, so I understand why he did it.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I would have let off with it. I would have been like,
yeah,
this is what we're doing. Because it's honestly a damn good episode.
Yeah.
It's funny and heartwarming, and everybody is great, and everybody's trying to keep the secret. Everybody's trying to not get whacked. The Don is trying to hold on to his toy that he know he can't have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were a lot of good elements that I love. If you were to show this episode to me after the pilot, I would be hooked.
Yeah. I would agree with that, actually.
I think we may have talked about this on a previous episode, is throughout the entire run of the series, I felt like Don Bellisario felt like he had to play it safer.
Yep.
Because for some reason, he never thought like the audience was totally on board with the premise, so he always felt like he couldn't push the story too far. I didn't feel like he trusted the audience enough to be on board.
Well, and I would even say that, you know, in addition to not trusting the audience, I think he probably didn't trust, you know, the network. Mm. I think that there was a big element of, you know, I'm getting by, you know. The show would struggle. You know, the show struggled a bit in its first season, even. Mm-hmm. Struggled a little bit in the second season. It kind of found its footing, you know, towards the end of the second season, third season. But it was never, like, a huge ratings hit. Mm-hmm. You know, and it did get some degree of critical acclaim. And, mm-hmm. you know, like we talked about, it won some Emmys. It was mm-hmm. nominated for Golden Globes and Emmys. And,
it,
you know.
Mm-hmm. But I think at one point, I don't know how they tracked this at the time, but at one point it was the most taped show.
Mm, interesting.
How do you track that?
Like, right? I don't know. I mean, I have no idea.
Yeah.
But as far as, like, people who taped it to watch it later, because for a good portion of its run, it was on Friday nights.
Right, exactly. And you know, and it's interesting, too, because this was the last Friday night episode of this season. The mm. next episode was switched to Wednesday nights,
yes.
which would end up being kind of its home base for a good portion of, mm-hmm. the run of the show. I think that had it been the second episode, I mean, I really enjoyed Starcrossed, and I think that Starcrossed is a fun episode to go into right after the pilot, but I also think that it's sort of a heavy episode in some ways with the, you know, Sam's fiance who left him at the altar being there, and, mm-hmm. you know, and all this other stuff that happens. I think it would have been interesting had this been the episode in between,
mm-hmm.
You know, had Starcrossed been third as opposed to the second episode. The double leap being the logic behind not having it be mm-hmm. the second episode doesn't make a lot of sense to me, especially considering that we know that one of the intentions of the series from the get-go was that there would always be a secondary leap in an episode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like much like the pilot has the baseball leap, this episode has the Don leap, that there was going to be the idea that we would get a little bit of either the next leap or another leap within an episode.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows? Who knows the exact reasons why? But mm-hmm. I think it's, in my opinion, the pilot aside, it might be the strongest episode so far on the whole. Again, I really like Starcrossed. And I think that this is definitely a lighter episode. It feels a little bit fluffier in some ways. But I think it holds together better than the others do.
I think it's a fun hour of television. I think, and this is differing in opinion from you, Sam, I think it is the most un-Quantum Leap of any of the early episodes.
Really? Okay. Huh. I see, yeah, I do disagree. I think that there's something about this one that it doesn't feel as overstuffed as Right Hand of God.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel as just kind of weird as How the Test Was Won feels. I think Starcrossed might edge it out for feeling a little bit more Quantum Leap.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something about the Sam we get in this episode compared to the Sam we get in Starcrossed mm-hmm. that feels more like the Sam that we'll get for the next 90 episodes.
Character-wise, I can see that. It's more like, specifically, like, there is no objective. There is no what is Sam there to do
sure.
for three
That's
quarters
a
of
very,
the,
very good
for
point.
Three quarters of the episode.
Yeah. It is, yeah, you're absolutely right about that. It is definitely an odd duck in that respect, because mm-hmm. it doesn't have the mission, the obstacle, etc., whereas some of the other episodes do. The next episode that we're going to talk about,
mm-hmm.
I think, actually has a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
But speaking of
to bring around and as a segue going into to the next episode, talking about like how Don Bellisario didn't trust the viewers or the network, the next episode that we're going to talk about, his wife at the time wrote it, Deborah Pratt,
yep.
who was a producer on the series. He did not want to do that episode in the first season. He wanted to wait until the second or third season because he did not think the audience would be on board for Sam to leap into a black man.
Yeah. Which we didn't actually say yet, that mm-hmm. he leaps out, and when he leaps out, we don't
Here
get
we
star
are.
Crossed. What we get is he's sitting down mm-hmm. at a counter in a restaurant.
Yes.
And clearly there are people in the background looking at him mm-hmm. in a sort of like odd way,
uh-huh.
and Sam, of course, is completely unaware as he looks across into the mirror, and staring back at him is the face of a black man,
mm-hmm.
an older black man,
mm-hmm.
and even the music at this point is very much sort of like, oh shit.
Uh-huh. But it's also interesting, and a lot of times, like at the end of episodes, the end of the episode, like when Sam leaping into a situation, it was sometimes a little bit different than the situation he leaped into just for time.
Yeah.
So, like, he leaps in, he's already sitting at the counter.
Yeah.
Whereas we see at the start of the next episode, he's standing up when he leaps in, and it's Sam's choice to sit down at the counter, not the person he leaped into's choice.
Right, which we'll get into more on the next episode. Mm-hmm. So, double identity, to sum up, I think that it is, much like you said, I think it's a fun hour of television. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good episode of Quantum Leap. I would probably, again, it would be tough for me to put it above Star-Crossed, but I would certainly say that it's close. At this particular point in time, I would absolutely argue, though, that we have not had a great episode of Quantum Leap yet. That's about to change, mm-hmm. but Pilot included, which I enjoy, Star-Crossed, mm-hmm. which I enjoy, Double Identity, which I like, we've not yet had a great episode.
Fair enough.
Any other final thoughts before we leap out of here?
Nah.
Mm. I think that pretty well sums it up.
All right. Well, thank you, listeners, very much, and we'll catch you next time.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed what you've heard or have any questions or comments, don't be shy. Reach out to us online at www.quantumleappod.com or Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And remember to hit the subscribe button and leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may be listening. Until next time. If